The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, June 6th, 2019, the Dan Coyce Returns Edition. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. I'm a journalist and podcaster living in New Hampshire. And my kids are Henry, who is 17, Teddy, who is 16, and my stepdaughter, Lily, who is almost 19.
And I'm Dan Coyce. I'm an editor and writer at Slate, and I'm the author of How to Be a Family, which comes out in September. I'm the dad of Lyra, who is now 14, and Harper, who is 11. And I'm back, baby!
Let's talk about that. You are back, like, for real, right?
I am back for real. I am now joining Rebecca as a weekly co-host of Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's amazing parenting podcast.
Well, you just, like, I just want to take a second before we preview the show. Like, just tell me a little bit about your family. Can you just do that real quick? Can you catch me up? Because I was not a podcaster on this show when you were on this show. And the only way that I know you is from your guest hosting stints when I've been on the show. So can you just orient me and maybe the audience who sort of came in the post-Dan years, just like, what is your family like?
What's our deal? We live in Arlington, Virginia, which is a suburb of D.C. My wife's name is Alia. She's an attorney. I work at Slate. My kids are both in middle school, sixth and eighth grade, two girls. They spent many years being the subjects of triumphs and fails, mostly fails that I would then spin as triumphs, for this podcast, way back when I launched it with Allison Benedict many years ago. The most notable thing about our family is that we spent a year traveling around the world for the purposes of this book that I have written, which is coming out in September, which in some ways has given my kids a completely different view of their suburban life. And in some ways, they have completely pushed out of their memories because it was so traumatic that they wish never to think or speak of it again.
Well, now that we have the background, we can talk about what's coming up today on the show. We've got a question about what the deal is with siblings anyway, and a question about what to do with a kid who refuses to go anywhere, even when the where is somewhere super fun. Plus, triumphs, fails, and recommendations. And today on Slate Plus, it is 420. That's right. We are talking about marijuana and kids and whether or not the two mix, sort of, and the kind of controversy that's dusted up. So go to slate.com/momanddadplus, join Slate Plus, and you can get that extra segment of the podcast, plus all future extra Slate Plus versions of the podcast. All right, let's kick off the show with triumphs and fails. Dan, do you have a triumph or a fail this week?
I have a triumph this week, you know, with elements of failure, as always. a coaching triumph. This is maybe a more long and involved story than you were in the market for, Rebecca, but
no, I like it.
In order to explain the sort of modest triumph that I managed this softball season, I need to go way back in time to the reason that I have always frequently, I've always described myself when people ask as retired from coaching. By which I mean, when I say that I coached Lyra's soccer team in kindergarten and first grade. And then after that, I was like, fuck this shit, because it took up so much time and so much energy. And also, I just felt completely stymied all the time how to teach like a first grader about soccer. And so I spent every practice just like blowing my whistle incessantly, trying to get everyone to pay attention. And because I was bad at teaching everyone about soccer, we lost all the time. And I know winning is not the point, but if you lose all the time, the kids do not really have a particularly good time when you're like losing 8-1. And that was like definitely my fault. I felt like I was not doing the kids any service whatsoever. Everyone was having a bad time. So I retired. And that was fine for a while because Lyra, just a few short years after that, also retired from team sports. So it wasn't a problem. But Harper, my younger daughter, is super into sports. And so she has asked me like a million times, why don't you coach my teams? And for the most part, I've had a really great excuse, which is that the coaches she already has on all her various teams are really good. They're really good at what they do. They're all moms and dads who just like know a lot about the sports and are very enthusiastic and great. And I love them. And so I could say, oh, well, you don't need me. You've already got, you know, Coach Brian. And I particularly love her softball coach, her coach for many years on a team called the Pink Thunder. You can tell she's been on it for many years because Pink Thunder is clearly the name a third grader gives her softball team. But they've kept it all these years. But this guy's named Steve. He is extremely good at teaching fundamentals. He's really chilled out. He's really nice. He's upbeat and positive, and he always makes sure everyone gets to play an equal amount, and he never yells. He's totally great. I feel like he's a real anomaly among even like elementary school sports coaches. He has long had two assistant coaches, and one is another dad who is also usually pretty mellow. And then for many years, there was the au pair. One of the players' family's au pairs is a former college softball player, you know, an extremely good former pitcher. And she joined the Pink Thunder as an assistant coach, which in theory was great because, like, what a great role model for all of our daughters. But in practice, she was just way too intense. She was like college softball intense with third and fourth graders. And so she just made softball completely unfun for everyone, I think, including Coach Steve, though he was far too nice ever to say anything about it. But she would just like yell and scold, and she would have this very stern coach attitude. And Harper was not into that, and it did not seem like the other players were. And I definitely was not. But, you know, she really knows softball, so what are you supposed to do? But then this season, the au pair's kid, the kid from that family, ascended to a more competitive team in a fancier suburb. So all of a sudden the team was free of this mean coach, which I thought was great. But now we were down a coach. And at the first game of the season, Coach Steve needed someone in the dugout to like be the bench coach during games, which just means you're like getting everyone ready for their at-bats, and you're reminding people who's on deck and where they're playing, and you help the catcher get her gear on and all that stuff. So I agreed to be that guy. And it turned out I liked it. I really enjoyed it. I mean, so I liked that I could stand in the shade in the dugout instead of being sitting in the hot sun with all the parents who shout all the time, and that stresses me out. But I also just liked the actual, like the very minimal coaching in which I was engaged. I liked like joking with the girls in the dugout, and I liked that when Harper would come back from an at bat, I could high five her. And I like that during games, I would just like say some totally innocuous baseball phrase like, oh, bases loaded, girls. And then Daisy, who is a player on the team, a delightful kid who's like a team's official cheerleader, would just instantly launch into an official softball cheer on the subject of the bases being loaded. Like, bases loaded, pitcher's nightmare, batter's dream, batter's dream. And mostly I just like that I was like, I could be like a chill voice in the dugout, and I could encourage the girls, and I could do my best to make sure that everyone didn't stress out about winning too much. So wow. This past weekend was the, you think the story's over, Rebecca, but it's not.
No, I don't think it's over. I think that it's fascinating that that is like the role you play as a coach. I live in a very competitive sports town. And I think my kids probably would have stayed in more sports if there were more parents who saw that as the role they could play as one of the volunteer coaches on their programs.
I don't know that there are a lot of coaches like me in Arlington. And I mean, it's also an extremely competitive sports town. But so like as an example of this, this weekend was the playoffs. The playoffs started this weekend in the Pink Thunder. So they're in they ascended this year to a division, which is very broad. It includes sixth graders through ninth graders. And in theory, that means that you would have sixth through ninth graders in every team. But what it actually means is there's teams of sixth graders, then there's teams of like eighth and ninth graders. So Harper's team, which is all sixth graders, was just constantly playing against teams made up of people who like just look like grown women. But still somehow they finished third in their division because we have a couple of really good pitchers, including Daisy, and because Steve is like a good coach. He like taught them really well. And so in our first playoff game, we were facing a team of eighth and ninth graders. You know, it even included the older sister of a kid on our team. So there was a lot of like emotionally charged moments between those two. And they were very juiced up for this game. And the girls on our team were somewhat nervous. All of a sudden it was the playoffs and it seemed very serious. And Steve remained very even keeled, but even like our other assistant coach was like a little bit amped up. He was giving the girls all kinds of like very intense instruction in the dugout before the game. And then I was like, oh, also don't forget to have fun. And he was like, winning is fun. And I was like, buddy, don't let the playoff spirit get you too hard. But so the game was very close and exciting. And then in like the fourth inning, Daisy had come to pitch, and the opposing coach, immediately following her first pitch, the opposing coach came out to the ump and made a whole like big to do about how Daisy's back foot would occasionally slip off the pitching rubber during her motion. And therefore that was an illegal pitch, and the ump had to do something about it. And so Steve went out there and he was like trying to be cool about it, but like, come on, this is the coach of a bunch of eighth graders yelling about a sixth grader's pitching motion, which doesn't even like give her any advantage. And I like could not believe that this was happening. And I'm like back in the dugout, you know, telling the girls, don't worry about it, it's fine. Coach Steve is taking care of it. Anyway, Daisy got rattled and they got a bunch of hits and we fell behind by one run and we could never score that last run and we lost by one. But so here's my triumph. My triumph is that through this season, up to and including an intense competitive softball game, I found a way to coach, to be involved in a sport that I really like with my kid without driving myself or my kid crazy. And in that final game, I kept the dugout extremely positive and fun, even though we lost a very tough game. Although at one point I did say loudly enough for all of our players to hear that the opposing coach was being a real dick. But anyways, thanks for a fun season, Pink Thunder. It was great.
Though that's an important thing for them to know. That's just being transparent. I like it.
I thought he was. Yeah. Like I felt like they suspected it. And to hear an adult confirm that was valuable. It was like, it was the one bit of teaching I could really offer them.
That's right. That's right. You validated the feelings they were having inside by expressing them out loud. That was very good. I like it very much. Well, I have
How about you? What do you have?
A fail. I just went on a work trip to Nashville to go to a conference for a few days. And
Fun city.
Yes. And yes. The city of where people feel comfortable saying woo a lot. Like woo. That should be their tourism slogan. Like let your inner woo out. Come to Nashville. Anyway, my son Henry has now demonstrated from a previous trip that Kevin and I took that he can house sit and dog sit for us while we're away. He's a high school senior about to graduate. He's a super responsible kid. And so that was our plan. Like you are going to house and dog sit for us while we were away. And I think this trip was about the same length as the last trip we took. It was like our plane left at like 6 a.m. on Thursday. So we like I said goodnight to him Wednesday night. And then like we weren't coming back until like midnight on Sunday. So it was an extended like 4 days. And then, of course, we ended up our plane like got way late on the way back by some weather. So we just spent an extra night like in Atlanta. So he ended up watching the house for sort of a long time. So we're in Nashville and we're at this conference and it's super fun for us. It's like podcast stuff and we're with our podcast people and our podcast fans and we're doing shows and panels and it's like all very immersive. And of course, you're in Nashville. So Nashville being the city of like cool mid-century architecture and honky-tonks that are definitely fire hazards. There's like a lot to see and do and sort of absorb while you're there. So we're doing all that. And I get a text from Henry on Sunday morning after I've been in Nashville for 1, 2, 3 days. And he says, so what time are you guys coming home today? And I realized I have not called home a single fucking time the entire time I've been in Nashville. And I have left my two teenage kids alone to their own devices. Like, I recently got Henry a credit card on my credit card account, like just for exactly like stuff like this. And also just like for when he goes to college, like if he needs to like get himself to an urgent care clinic and needs to pay the copay or whatever. And I had said, you know, if you need to buy food or whatever while we're gone, use the credit card, whatever. Like I had equipped him. But like sort of the basic fundamental thing of like calling or texting and saying, hey, how's everything going? Is everything okay? How's the house? How are you? Do you have everything you need? Totally fucking forgot to do it. I just forgot to check in at all. And to be fair, like he didn't check in with me either, but he's also the child and I'm the parent. So yeah, huge fail. Huge. I mean, nothing bad happened, but still, I just felt like, as you so gracefully put it, I felt like a super dick. I called him and I was like, I just realized I haven't called you. He's like, yeah, I thought that was kind of weird that you never called. He's like, I saw your Instagram post though. It looks like you're having a good time. So yeah.
So you were communicating with him in a way.
Yes, I was performatively communicating with him.
My feeling about a trip to Nashville is that if you called your kid, they would just be like, why do you sound so drunk? So why like invite that conversation?
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a very fair point.
Yeah.
There was one really
funny. Mom called, but all she said was woo.
She was calling from one of those pedal taverns. There was one really funny moment when we first got there. Like, we went down to Broadway during the day. We first got there to sort of like check out the scene. And everybody had said, like, if you're going to go down and check it out, like, go during the day because it's like less crazy. And we're old. So we went down there and we sort of were like, you know, every single honky tonk says world famous in the sign. So like, how are you to know which one to go into? They literally all say they're world famous, which I
even the one in the
doubt can be true.
World famous.
Exactly. So we chose one because the band inside was playing a very sort of rock and country cover of Don Henley's Boys of Summer. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So we went into that one and we were sitting there drinking like horrible, very like frat like drinks, like bright pink and bright yellow drinks out of plastic cups at this bar. And there are all these people standing at this super long bar watching something on TV and cheering. And I was like, oh, we should go see what they're watching. They were watching the finals of the Scripps National Spelling Bee and like cheering for the kids. And that
That's
was how
so
I ended up watching the Spelling Bee. It was at this honky tonk drinking like a bright pink drink in Nashville. It was very fun. But I also forgot to call my kid. So there's that.
My feeling is work trips, you know what? All rules are off. You had a good time. Everything turned out fine. If you asked your kid, I bet he like secretly views it as his triumph that without any, he needed no help whatsoever and he did just fine.
Yeah. Apparently even prevented there from being a party at the house. Like some kids like showed up and he was like, no, you can't. I didn't clear this. You can't. And yeah, apparently he did all those things.
I can't clear it. I don't even know how to get hold of my mom.
She hasn't called me. Exactly.
Good one.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right. Now it's time for us to do the business. I don't know if I've ever done the business before. This is very exciting for me. As always, if you have a question you'd like us to answer on air, leave us a message at 424-255-7833, or you can email us at momanddad@slate.com. Also, check out our Facebook group. Just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. It's a super fun community. I'm on it. Dan Kois is on it. And we moderate it so it doesn't get out of control. And in Slate Plus today, it's 420. That's right. We're talking about the devil's lettuce, jazz cigarettes, that wacky tobacco, and how to deal with an evolving pot culture when you also have kids. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program, and it's a great way to support this show. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing Mom and Dad Are Fighting and your other favorite Slate shows. And in return, you get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other benefits. So if you want to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. All right, onward.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, it's time for our first listener question. This question was sent by email and is being read by Shasha Leonard. If you want to send us a question, email it to momanddad@slate.com.
Dear Mom and Dad are fighting. We have two boys, ages 5 and 3. Our oldest will be starting kindergarten this fall and lately is very into being independent and doing things for himself. Lately, we've had a few incidents where he refuses to go somewhere. The library, a play date, usually a kid-centric activity, and throws a screaming, crying fit. In an effort not to reward that behavior by letting him stay home with one of us, we've historically just forced his shoes on him and forced him into the car. He always eventually calms down a few minutes into the ride and ends up having fun and enjoying the outing. But he's getting older and bigger, and this is still happening. Dominating him physically isn't a tenable situation. And it seems wrong. How do you get a kid to do something they don't want to do? Do you give him what he wants when he's being a dick about it? At what age can they start opting out of doing family activities? And we just have to accept that. I've had many conversations with him, trying to suss out why he doesn't want to go or why he changed his mind when he previously agreed to go. I'm getting nowhere. He just repeats, because I don't want to. Usually, we're going to do something fun, so I'm at a loss. Is this a control thing? You all have older kids, so I'm hoping you can share some insights on whether this behavior improves with age and how we should handle these situations. Thanks in advance.
So let me start by validating this caller's emotions. Your child is being a dick about it. And yes, you're correct. It's a control thing. It's extremely common for five-year-olds to feel this tension between the independence that you stress under lots of circumstances, right? You want them to be independent about getting ready for bed or brushing their teeth, or they're still remembering how much you praise them about the potty and how independent they were for that. Especially with a younger brother, age 3, he's constantly comparing himself to the smaller kid who's less independent and who is more, and who can't do the things that he can do. So on the one side, you have this independent streak that he's exhibiting and being praised for. And on the other side, you have this dawning realization that he is subject to your rules and your whims. And it's not at all uncommon for a five-year-old to have major problems with that and to really push hard against that. He wants to find ways to exert control. And you are right at the point of parenting where you're discovering how hard parenting gets when it gets much more difficult to just physically lift your child up and put them in the place where you want them to be. That is like the only really good thing about years 2 and 3 are that if all else fails, you can just pick your child up and exit them from the situation in which they have embroiled you. So you have this kid who doesn't want to do the stuff you want him to do, who eventually discovers that the stuff is fun in classic kid tradition. You force him to do the thing and then he discovers that he likes it. What I can tell you to start with is that this kind of behavior does fade, at least for most kids, that starting around 6 or 7, it's a lot easier to reason with a child, to use examples from past times that they have done something and found it enjoyable, to bargain with them in some way, to think about rewards for doing the things that you want them to do and to have those rewards stick and be useful in terms of actually changing their behavior. And that does get better, and that you're at sort of a particularly peak age where the child is very unmaneuverable and also very willful, and it gets very tough to make them do things. So that's the first thing I can offer, is that your experience isn't uncommon. yes, it should get better for some particular window until like maybe 11 or 12 when the rejections get often get more firm and when that sort of rearing independence reaches a whole new level. And that's the point, I think, usually for most families where just flat out opting out of a parent of a family activity can and should be an option that you occasionally offer kids. Rebecca, what do you think?
Well, I'm really glad that you took this question first because we are going to have our first disagreement as co-hosts of this podcast.
Finally, while, mom and dad are fighting.
I agree with, you know, a lot of what you said, but I don't agree that this kid is being controlling. I don't think a five-year-old has the intention of trying to control what his parents or his family or anybody are doing when they exhibit this behavior. And I think that when you think about it as a kid trying to be controlling, you're setting yourself up for a power struggle with a five-year-old. Because when your perception is that, oh, this kid is trying to control the situation, your instinct is to say, well, I'm the adult, I'm the parent, it's my job to control the situation. And the next thing you know, you're literally locking horns with a five-year-old, figuratively locking horns with a five-year-old, I should say. So what I think—
Unless your family is cows. If your family is cows,
exactly.
Then you are—
Or mountain goats. Literally. Or mountain goats, yes. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the way that I would look at this and the way that I learned to look at this when I struggled with this for many years with my son Henry, who would routinely just ruin our day by doing a lot of the same things you're describing here, is that it isn't about him trying to control you or your family's activities. It is about the difference, which is a vast, dark void of a gulf between what his expectations are and what it is that now he's being told is happening. And even if you give a kid like yours warning, like, hey, later today, we're going to be going to the library or whatever, that doesn't quite line up with the expectation of where the kid is when that time actually arrives and they're sitting in their room playing with their Legos. Like, I know that you said it earlier, this was going to happen later, but the expectation for him right now is that he's going to be sitting on the floor playing with his Legos. And the reality is that he's now being told he has to go somewhere else. And that is a very, very painful gulf for some kids to cross. And it actually really, like, emotionally and physically makes them feel something. So I think the key is to understand that the feelings he's exhibiting here are real. They're absolutely real to him. He is having an emotional reaction to the difference between his expectation and reality. When you start seeing it that way, it becomes a lot easier to come up with ways to prepare for and navigate this. What we did with Henry was, you know, when we had a Saturday kind of ahead of us with lots of activities, what we learned to do, and to be completely fair with you, we did go to some family counseling to learn some of these tools, and it really helped. Was once you sort of understand where those emotions and the resistance is coming from, you can come up with a plan that your kid actually participates in. So instead of saying, hey, later today we're doing this or this or this, we would frame it as an agreement. So we'd say, so let's just talk about what the expectations for today are. There's going to be like an hour where we're going to like hang out after breakfast and then not do anything. But then at that point, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and put your shoes on and your backpack, get your backpack packed and everything, because then we're going to do this. Is that cool? Like, do you agree? And you have to sort of get them to say, like, yeah, that's fine, because, you know, and then as the time approaches, you sort of, you know, sort of remind and reinforce that you, not that you're about to do something they don't want to do, but that you made the agreement. You sort of remind them, hey, remember earlier when you said you were psyched to get on your shoes and backpack? Like, that's coming up in 15 minutes. And then you sort of give cues based on the agreement, not based on the thing. So that worked really, really well for us. It does take time to sort of train the kid's brain and to train your own brain to go there. And it really helps. But the most important part of the whole formula and the only thing that makes it work is that when it fails and your kid is super upset and resisting and full of rage and sad because they don't want to go do the stupid fun thing that you know is going to be fun and you find yourself like battling, the thing to do is acknowledge the feelings are real and even like hug your kid and be like, oh my God, I know how you feel. Come here, give me a hug, blah, 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 blah. Acknowledge the feelings, soothe the feelings, and then go back to the agreement. That would be my recommendation for this, would be just to not think of it as a power struggle at all. And then to just come up with tools, like, doesn't have to be exactly what I laid out, but that's what really worked for us.
Did you find that then referring to that agreement in the moment was convincing to your kids? That just seems like
sometimes
exactly the kind of thing that my kids would respond like, I don't care about that agreement.
Well, sometimes. But the nice thing about that is it becomes about a third party thing. So another thing that like was a huge tip around this that we used a lot was made it a third party thing where you could then say like, listen, I'm on your team here. Like we have this plan. We made this plan. And, you know, unfortunately, like if we don't get here at the specific time, like that's just the time that the thing is at. And that's not my fault. That's not your fault. But like we got to get there. And you sort of make it like you're working together to accomplish something rather than you fighting
against your common enemy, the agreement.
You know, your common enemy, the agreement, or your common enemy, the time of day, or your common enemy, like the store closes at so-and-so time, or the common enemy, like this came up a lot with like food. And like, one thing that I learned to do was point to the box of food and be like, look, it's not my fault. The box says you're only supposed to have 3 cookies. Like, that's not me. It's Sarah Lee. Like, you need to call them if you have an issue with that. And then you sort of come up with ways to be on the same team as your kid. What makes this hard though, and what I really like feel her pain here, is that she's a 5-year-old and 3-year-old. Like my kids were 18 months apart. And if they're anything like her kids, like my kids, the younger one was super easygoing and would do whatever when he was little. And the older kid was like a giant pain in the ass. So like the younger kid would just be sitting in the car, like waiting while we were having this like protracted negotiation on a lawn. And it just made it all seem like so much more fraught. You know what I mean?
Here's the other suggestion I would make. I do think that there is still an element of control. I don't think it's about the 5-year-old trying to control her, but I do think it's about the 5-year-old trying to exert control over himself and his body and the activities that he wants to do. And I don't think our answers are actually that different from each other in that I agree with you completely that it is crucial to bear in mind the kind of emotional response that a kid has to feeling surprised, even though it isn't a surprise, to feeling stymied in the things he wants to do, even though you told him you were going to do those things. And that responding to those emotions and taking them seriously is a really valuable part of this. And I also think an agreement can be really worthwhile, but I might encourage this caller or this letter writer to take it even a step further and not to be all, here are some tips for my upcoming book, but, there's a thing that Dutch parents do.
Wait, I'm counting the plugs. I'm making hash marks. I think we're up to 3 now. 1, 2, 3. Oh, yeah. Okay, keep going.
You better have a lot of space on that paper. So there's a thing that Dutch parents do, which when we lived in the Netherlands, which was one of the 4 countries that we lived in for my book, How to Be a Family, coming September 17th from Little Brown, that is called poldering. And while we lived in the Netherlands, I found it fucking maddening and had a very difficult time with it. Since we have left, I have sort of managed to adapt it in certain ways and have found it more useful. And I think it is particularly useful for small kids in a situation just like this, where they're just learning how difficult it can be to come to grips with a thing that other people want you to do that you are not, that you don't want to do at that exact moment. Poldering very simply just means, the Dutch way of hashing everything out ahead of time and negotiating plans, ideas, and rules before they happen. And so it's a little bit like making that agreement, but it also means that you are explicitly allowing kids to have a say in what those activities are. And so rather than 3 or 4 or 5 hours ahead of time saying, hey, our plan at 3 o'clock, we're going to the library and it's going to be really fun and you're going to love it. So let's make an agreement that we're going to do that. You talk through it with them. You take their suggestions about what they want to do. You talk about what you want to do. You take their suggestions seriously. And even sometimes, this is the part I hated the most, change your plans in response to what the kids actually want to do. And even if in the end you come to basically the same result that you were going to come to anyway, maybe your kid says, I want to do it at 3:30 instead of 3, or maybe your kid says, I want to stop here before we go to the library or whatever. You have not only an agreement, right, to do this thing, but you also have the kids' memory and knowledge that they were part of that decision-making process. And so therefore, you have a little bit more of their buy-in. So that is a thing you can refer to at 3 o'clock or 3:15 when the kid wants to play with his Legos and he doesn't want to go to the library. You're not just saying, hey, you know, we came to this agreement, we have to abide by this agreement. You can say, hey, you and I talked about this, and here were the reasons you wanted to do this. And you were interested in this, and this is something we worked out together. So let's stick with this agreement that is our plan that we made. with little kids particularly, I find that just that tiny bit of agency and authority that this process gives them can be really beneficial down the road in helping them feel like, okay, I wish I was still playing Legos, but I remember talking about this and being interested and excited in this plan that we came up with together. I find that really valuable.
It's cues, right? It's like you are providing cues to like relive the excited emotions you had earlier. It's sort of like you're trying to trigger that feeling of being positive. And, you know, that's something you can kind of do physically too. Like you can, there's a lot of exercises you can teach kids like this to do, like especially this is a perfect age, like five, sort of like, you know, taking deep breaths, unclenching your fist. Like when kids get mad, they sort of like clench their fists in these situations. And if you just like teach your kid to unclench your fist or just give him that cue, like there is something that sort of connects immediately. This is how I feel when my fists aren't clenched, which is better than I feel now. Right. But I really like that. Are you going to be dropping all kinds of like European parenting knowledge on us? This is very exciting.
Well, you know what? I've got parenting knowledge from around the world, Rebecca.
Ooh, very exciting. Multicultural Amazing. Parenting knowledge. I'm very excited about that. All right. Well, let's move on to our next question. This one is also being read by Shasha Leonar.
Dear Mom and Dad are Fighting, I very much enjoy your podcast and the insights you share. We have wonderful twins, a girl and a boy, who are now half a year old. I have about a million questions, but since my husband and I are both only children, this one seems the most relevant. How do siblings work? I know this is broad, but really, any advice is appreciated. Thank you.
What a so great full disclosure, question.
Yeah, it was. I saw this. I loved it. And I was like, we have to answer this question. Literally, you could give any answer to this question. It would be right, right?
Right.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older brother. He's 5 years older than me. And you?
I do. I'm the youngest of three. I have two older sisters. And I don't know if the answer is different for twins than it is for siblings of different ages. And I don't know if the answer is different for kids who are different genders rather than the same gender. I can tell you like a lot of anecdotal stuff about, you know, what I have seen and suspect. I don't know a ton about twins, but I do know that among all of my like friends, when there are kids where the kids are different genders, the dynamic just seems to be a little easier to navigate than kids of the same gender. Not 100% sure if that is true across the board, but so I don't know if I can tell you for sure how siblings work, but I can tell you how they work in my family, which is that my sons, who are very close in age, they're 18 months apart, as I said earlier, have what I like to describe as a love-kill relationship, where they adore each other. Like they absolutely, if you get them each independently and they will both just say that they love each other. They look out for each other. They think about things like the fact that someday they're going to be adults and like they're going to want to have a relationship. And so, you know, they think about stuff like that. They imagine a world in which they are always going to kind of like be together as a unit of some kind. And adding to that, the fact that, you know, me and their dad got divorced when they were young, they were really the only constants in their lives because they would go back and forth to each of our houses. And like, but they, the other sibling was always there. So they've always been very much constant for each other. But that doesn't mean that they also don't absolutely fucking disdain each other like a great deal of the time. And like the way that it manifested itself when they were little is they would just get into like fights, like straight up, like on the lawn, rolling around, scratching each other's eyes out fights, or just like stupid disagreements. Like, you know, what happens now is that Henry, who really just kind of has his shit together, like all around, even though intellectually he's like, Teddy is made of different kinds of stuff than I am. He has different talents than I do. You know, he's good at different things than I am. The fact that Teddy just can't get his shit together just completely annoys and sometimes completely triggers Henry. And then Henry turns into a super dick to Teddy. And Teddy is the opposite. Like the fact that Henry has his shit together so much, like Teddy looks for opportunities to try to like topple his brother off a hill, you know, like he'll like a great example just happened last night. Henry and his girlfriend went hiking yesterday. They skipped school. It was senior skip day when all like the seniors skip school. And it was Henry's girlfriend's. Yeah, it was her birthday. So they went hiking. And like here, they're posting all these photos to Instagram. And Teddy sends me a text last night and he's like, Mom, I saw you liking and posting on all those hiking photos. He's like, you know, senior skip day was actually last week, right? And Henry was just skipping school today. And I was like, why the fuck would you tell me that? Don't narc on your brother. Jesus, what's the matter with you? And he's just like, you know, I just don't like it that he's lying to you. I'm like, you do not care that he's lying to me. You were just taking the opportunity to be a narc and like try to get him in trouble, which, by the way, he isn't because he's graduating next week and like he could skip the next 5 days and it honestly does not fucking matter. But anyway, but I mean, I think the love is important. But you kind of got to know that that's the kind of shit you're going to have to navigate both when they're little and older. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think the whole sibling thing is all about?
One thing that was really hard for me to come to terms with as a parent of siblings, I think goes along a little bit with how you describe the relationship between your boys, which is like grasping the idea that the love that they have for each other is never going to be as sort of uncomplicated as my love for them, right? You know, which when you think about it, makes sense. Like Lyra is not Harper's dad. Lyra is not Harper's mom. Of course, she does not have the same kind of love or relationship with her as we have with them. But so, you know, you love each of your kids with a full and open heart, and you always will. You always do, even when you're upset at them. Like that is always there. And that's not to say that love that siblings have for each other is less than parental love, but it is definitely different, and it is definitely more complicated, more difficult at times to maintain, and less of a kind of driving force in their lives. They are essentially roommates who have a closeness born of proximity and familiarity and a kind of enforced closeness caused by all the things that parents do to make sure that a family feels like a family, right? The way you talk about how everyone on a family backs each other up and helps each other, and the way you talk about your love for each of them. But at the same time, there is this irritant in their life all the time. This thing, this person who they must deal with, who they have to treat civilly even when they don't want to, and who is like literally at times a rival for a thing that kids really, really need, like parental attention and affection. And so just the richness and weirdness of that relationship has been so fascinating for me to watch as it has evolved over 11 years now since Harper was born. And at the same time, it has frequently caused me like pain to see them treating each other badly in a way that I feel like I would never treat either of them, but in a way that I remember treating my brother or my brother treating me. And all of which is to say that like that the sibling relationship, I think, is in many ways a lot more mysterious to me than the parent-child relationship, even though I've been both and still am both. I understand a lot less about the sibling relationship, and I think it's a lot less predictable and it's a lot less likely to turn out any particular way based on what their childhoods are like. Twins seem like a whole like rich stew in and of themselves, and I've heard such wildly varying stories from parents of twins and from grown-up members of sets of twins about the kind of intense closeness of the early years and sometimes some kind of like violent split in the teenage years, but sometimes that never happens and twins remain like remarkably close and maintain that all the way through their adulthood. But like that, it seems like even 100 times more mysterious to me. I guess in the end, the answer I would give to how do siblings work is it's really hard to know, but that you definitely will never be bored or uninterested in watching it evolve over the years, like watching that dynamic be created and be maintained by them, even as you do your best to foster some kind of relationship between them. It's really going to grow up completely independent of you. And that is something pretty amazing to see.
You know, Dan, I'm really happy that you kind of brought up those issues about like the expectation of what the sibling relationship is like from the parents' perspective versus reality. Because, you know, the siblings, let's face it, they didn't choose to be in the same family together. They just are. And yeah, sometimes it's not great, right? Like sometimes your sibling is somebody that you wouldn't choose to be friends with if you had a choice. I mean, I have two sisters. One of them is more like me than the other. I think in the last few years, my relationship with both of them has been pretty good, but it hasn't always been, especially with one of my sisters, because we're just so different. And I don't think we would ever choose each other. You know, if we met at college, like we wouldn't have been roommates or friends, you know, we couldn't be more different. And one of the things that's made it so much harder for us to develop a healthy sort of adult dynamic between us is that there's so much pressure from my mother to like have a better relationship. I mean, almost every phone call I have with my mom at some point, she sort of bemoans that I'm not as close with my sisters as she would like us to be. And it's like, yeah, you have to let that go. Like the fact that you keep talking about it makes it so much worse. And the fact that like we actually do have an okay relationship is like never in the frame. And, you know, if my kids were just killing each other all the time and it wasn't love kill, it was just kill, I can imagine how that would hurt. That's not what you want. But it also doesn't help to say that that's how it has to be. And I think that's a really, really good point that you made.
It is so true that they didn't choose each other. Like that's like that is the thing to always remember. And so the only job you can do as a parent, I think, to like foster that relationship at all is to just help each kid see the things that you see in the other kid. And help them see those too and help them like act on those things and recognize those things and acknowledge those things. You never know. And it's so amazing to watch it. Like it's just, I found it just as fascinating as watching each individual kid grow up and learn things and become the person she's becoming has been watching that relationship evolve in many, many, many different ways and trying to stay out of it as much as I can.
That's really
good question. How do siblings work? It's a great question for the juggalos to answer. Like gravity. How does fucking gravity work? How do fucking siblings work? Tell us.
I'd love to know if listeners or just tell us on the Facebook group. I think this would be a good one for people to sort of let us know. Did we get it right or wrong?
Or just tell us about like what you have learned from the way your kids who are siblings interact and how that relates to what you were like as a sibling and what you still are like as a sibling. I just really want to hear those stories.
I do too. I'm still figuring it out. All right. Well, let's move on. Now is the time in the show where I'm going to keep it simple. Make recommendations. Dan, do you have any recommendations for our audience this week?
Ah, a recommendation. Yes. You mean a moment where I recommend a thing to someone else. Such a simple phrase. So easy to understand and comprehend. I'm going to recommend an old favorite of mine, something I'm sure that I recommended many, many years ago, but which I am currently revisiting. And it's making me so happy to revisit this thing. It's a series of books by Philip Pullman called His Dark Materials. They are YA fantasy novels written in Britain in the late 90s, a trilogy. That now, since the original trilogy was written, has now expanded somewhat into a few other books. I'm revisiting it because HBO is doing a miniseries based on the books this fall, starring who's in it? James McAvoy and Ruth Wilson and Lin-Manuel Miranda is in it. And I really love this series. I love it to the extent that as listeners may know or may have already guessed if they know the work, that we named our first kid after the main character in this series, who is a willful, stubborn, ill-tempered, mean little brat. And somehow we thought it was like a great idea to name a kid after that character. But we also love her. We love that character and we love these books. And we've been very pleased and happy with the way that our older daughter has grown into that name and also come to appreciate it upon reading the books herself. They're big epic stories based kind of on William Blake. They're sort of about adventure and kids going into magical worlds, and also sort of they're about a war on heaven and the death of God. They are written theoretically for an audience of 12 or 13-year-olds, but there are things about them I still don't understand very well, and I'm 44. Anyways, I'm rereading them for, you know, the 100th time. I recently started listening to a little bit of the audiobook of them with Harper, who has not read these books. And the audiobook is a beautiful production with rich, plummy British accents. And I just can't recommend this series enough. I think the HBO miniseries has a chance to be really good, much better than the movie they made out of the first book of the trilogy in the early 2000s, which was not good. I encourage people to experience this any way you can, but particularly if you have kids the right age, to have them spend the summer reading this so that when the miniseries comes this fall, you guys can watch it together.
That's really a recommendation. I actually was given that recommendation by a coworker who loves the books as much as you do after I sort of talked about how much I can't wait to watch that on HBO because, you know, I'm TV first. What can I say? I'm not as literate as you are.
The books are really good. Okay. They're really good. It's not like Game of Thrones where you can watch the series and then be like, great, thank God I don't have to read
exactly.
Those books.
Well, my recommendation is a TV show, but it's actually for adults, not kids. And I'm recommending it for parents for a couple of reasons. One is because it's one of those things that you're seeing everybody talk about in your social media feeds and how great it is. And you're thinking to yourself like, oh, I don't have the time to catch up on that whole thing that everyone already seems to know about. This thing is very short, even though there are two seasons. The seasons are only 6 episodes each, and each episode is only like 22 minutes, so it's like fewer than 6 hours of content. And the second reason I'm recommending it is because it is very pertinent to a lot of the things we talk about on the show. The show I'm recommending is the Amazon show called Fleabag. It is a brilliant, brilliant TV show. It is similar to, but not the same at all as Transparent in that what it is about isn't really sort of like the stated purpose of the show. What it's actually about is sort of like the dysfunction and beauty of familial relationships, sisters, parents and kids, shitty stepmoms. It is just so, so, so beautifully written and wonderful. And it was written and acted by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who also wrote the first season of Killing Eve, which is like a beautifully, beautifully written TV show. It starts out, I'll just give you a content warning. If you're thinking like, oh, I'll watch it with my teens, which I actually would recommend I've been doing. The first scene in the show is a super raunchy sex scene. After that, the content is adult, but like not as raunchy as that. But it's a great setup for the show and sort of develops the character super really well of Fleabag. So I really can't recommend it enough. We watched the entire series on our sort of stalled flight situation back from Nashville to Manchester, New Hampshire. That's how easy it is to catch up on. And it's one of those things where like, you know how when you have kids and like all the cool people in your life are like watching a thing and you're like, I don't have time. This is something you can do. So I recommend it. And then you'll have something to talk about with all the cool people that you work with. Have you seen Fleabag, Dan?
You can't see me right now, but I'm actually looking at the camera. I'm giving it a wry glance while you discuss the show. Fleabag is famous for the sort of the gimmick of the show, which becomes apparent instantly, is that it's a fourth wall breaking show. The main character is constantly talking to the camera, explaining things to the camera, just giving the camera sort of the sly glance. And it's a pretty effective tool, not only for conveying information to us, but also showing us the moments in which the main character, Fleabag, is deluding herself or fooling herself or uncomfortable. And so it works pretty well. I've seen the first 3 episodes. We're watching it. We just started this past weekend. We're watching one a night. It's very easy to catch up on. It really is like the kids go to bed and then 20 minutes later, you finished a satisfying episode of TV.
Exactly.
I'm not convinced about it yet. Everyone I know loves it so much, including you. The first 3 episodes have me thinking that it is very funny, but I'm not convinced that it can possibly do all the things that everyone says it does, but I'm definitely going to keep watching. And in the context of our conversation about siblings, the sister relationship on Fleabag is holy shit. Like there's a lot going on.
Yep. It's spot on. So I say to you, Dan, keep going and we can catch up next week and you can let me know what you think of the show then. Okay.
By then I'll be done because there's, it's so, you can just knock it out. It's great. It is true that all TV shows should only be 6 episodes. And they should be short, and I should be able to watch them in a couple of days.
All of them. Everything, just for you.
Correct.
All right. Well, that is our show. If you have a question you want to ask us on air, leave us a message at 424-255-7833 or email us at momanddad@slate.com and join us on Facebook. Just search for Slate Parenting. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Benjamin Frisch and Jess Jupiter. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Dan Coyce, thanks so much for podcasting me this week. I can't wait to talk to you again next week.
Thanks so much. Also, all movies should be 1 hour and 20 minutes long.